The coming due from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll be determining what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views and the views of our guests. Right now, of course, we have with us, and we'll not take any calls because Richard Minister is only going to be with us for about 20 minutes. We're going to be talking about his book, Losing Bin Laden. Richard, are you there?
I am.
Thank you so very much. It's a fascinating, fascinating book. And, of course, this is the book that tells about how the president had an opportunity to have Sudan turn Bin Laden over to us, and he wouldn't take him. They had the opportunity to get all the files and records on this whole Al-Qaeda terrorist movement in 1996. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this story, and then about the incredible policies of the Clinton administration, which refused to address the terrorist threat?
Well, I got interested in this because my brother almost died on September 11th. He works at the Wall Street Journal, just across the street from the World Trade Center. He gets on the subway every morning around 8:30, Brooklyn Heights, and got off the number 5 World Trade Center. And on the morning of September 11th, I knew that he usually got off that train around 8:45, just before the first plane hit. And it's a long walk up out of the subway to the street. And I thought for sure he was gone. I couldn't reach him for hours, like many Americans. I was wondering if I was going to have to learn to live with life without someone I really cared about. Luckily, by the end of the day, we found Brendan, and he'd gone to work a little later than usual because he'd cut himself shaving. The total quirk of fate, he looked down, just got out on the subway, saw the blood on his shirt, went back to change it, and lived to tell about it. But it really made me start thinking. My mind as an investigative journalist works a little differently than some people's. I began wondering, looking at this operation, 9/11, it was a very complicated, fairly sophisticated piece of evil. I began wondering when they started planning it, and I started talking to my intelligence sources and was informed that the planning September 11th began in May 1998, began in the Clinton years. And that made me wonder three questions. One, what did Clinton know about Bin Laden? When did he know it? What did he do about it? And my book is really about answering those three questions. It's an attempt to lay out an entire history of the Clinton years, all of the chances they had to get Bin Laden. I found more than 12 opportunities to kill or capture Bin Laden that President Clinton passed up. Many of those chances, of course, have not been reported by the mainstream media, which doesn't want to look back at the Clinton years. And I found that the first attack Bin Laden made on Americans was just after Bill Clinton was elected, December 1992, even before he was sworn in.
I was so amazed. I had never even heard of that. I've studied this quite a bit, but that attack was in Yemen, wasn't it? And it was on a hotel. They thought the Americans were there for us, and they weren't.
Well, that's right. There were two hotel attacks that were supposed to be simultaneous, two towers, in fact. And one of those hotels was empty. The American troops were not in it. And there were 100 U.S. Marines in the other hotel, but a sharp-eyed security guard foiled that plot. And Clinton didn't even want a briefing. Tony Lake, the new National Security Advisor, told me that he wasn't particularly interested in that area.
Well, of course, the thing that really was so infuriating was he wouldn't even meet with the head of the CIA, his own appointee, Mr. Woolsey.
That's right. And I found out in my book, I report for the first time why Clinton never met with a CIA director in 2 years, never met with him face-to-face. And the reason is that Bill wanted a friend of his put on the CIA payroll. He wanted an old campaign contributor of his to be made top lawyer, chief counsel of the CIA. And Woolsey just didn't think the man was qualified. Besides, he had a general counsel.
So we're all going to be back here in just a moment with Richard Mittner, and we're going to be talking about his book, Losing Bin Laden. Wow. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Richard Miniter. We're going to be talking with him about losing bin Laden. Richard Miniter's wonderful book about how Bill Clinton's failure unleashed global terrorism. And, of course, we were chatting just a moment ago, and of course, Richard was saying that Bill Clinton refused to meet, or I think more than once or twice, with his own appointee, Woolsey, who was the James Woolsey, was the director of the CIA. And Woolsey, of course, was well aware of the fact that there was terrorism and a terrorist threat to America. And Bill Clinton just refused to meet with him. He was mad because Woolsey would not put an incompetent into a key position in his administration. You want to pick up the story from there?
That's right. He wouldn't put a friend of Bill on the payroll of the CIA, and so Bill Clinton punished him by freezing him out.
And, of course, in the meantime, of course, freezing out the information that could have saved thousands of American lives.
Absolutely right. And then he did other things, too, to cripple the CIA. Woolsey quickly figured out in 1993 that there was a real shortage of Arabic and Farsi language translators. The CIA was only able to decipher and translate 10% of its own intelligence intercepts in the Middle East. The other 90% was just unknown what secrets it might hold. So he wanted to hire more translators. And he got three out of the four congressmen who decide on the spending for the CIA to agree. But one senator, Dennis DeConcini, a Democrat of Arizona, was opposed. He didn't like the CIA. He'd been a longtime opponent of intelligence, and he didn't like Jim Woolsey. So he said that only if the president called him and told him that it was a presidential priority would he give the CIA the money to hire those translators. And Tony Lake, the National Security Advisor, went to Clinton and wanted him to call the senator. That call probably would have taken 30 seconds to a minute. Just say, hey, this is Bill. I want those translators. And it would have been done. But again, he was still in the mind to punish Woolsey, punish the CIA. Those translators weren't hired. And then after the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the CIA was cut out of the loop. So the FBI, they made it a criminal investigation, so only the New York office of the FBI knew what they were finding out, knew about the vast conspiracy that bin Laden had put together to set off that terrorist attack in February 1993.
And of course, you point out the fact that that first World Trade Center bombing where Ramzi Yousef was involved was actually an Al-Qaeda operation, and of course, the average American doesn't understand that.
That's right, but it's a matter of public record. You know, the court documents and the FBI documents are very clear on that subject.
I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're going to have to pull our last station on. They'll be here in just a moment, and then we'll go on from there. All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, our guest today is Richard Miniter. We're talking about his book, Losing Bin Laden. And of course, the interesting fact that most people are unaware of is that the first bombing of the World Trade Center back there in February of 1993 was actually a Osama bin Laden operation carried out by one of his agents, who was, of course, Ramzi Yousef. And what was the relation to this Sheikh Mohammed? Was he related to Ramzi Yousef, or was he related to bin Laden? Who was sort of the mastermind of that?
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is related by blood to Ramzi Yousef, and apparently by marriage to bin Laden.
All right, fine. I was a little confused because I always thought he was related by blood to Ramzi Yousef. And of course, he was the man.
Well, he is related by blood to Ramzi Yousef.
Right. And of course, they were over there in the Philippines together in 1995.
That's right.
All right, fine. Well, of course, let's get over to...
there's a much more damning connection between Ramzi Yousef, the mastermind of the World Trade Center bombing, and bin Laden. And that was when he was finally captured in Pakistan in 1995. They found a business card with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's name and phone number on it, and a picture of Ramzi Yousef with bin Laden posing with AK-47s.
And, of course, wasn't Ramzi Yousef at that time in a building owned by bin Laden?
That's right, yes.
So let's get, of course, to this whole scenario as far as the Sudan. I wish we could develop the whole idea, but I understand you can only be with us for relatively few minutes.
But I'd be happy to come back anytime, sir.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to that. But let's get to the scenario with the sedan, 1996, and, of course, to get the United States to lift the sanctions on a sedan, why the government there is willing to turn Osama bin Laden over to us. He's already been involved with the explosion of an attempt to kill Americans in 1992, with the February 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, with, of course, the Black Hawk Down episode in October of 1993 in the sedan, of course, with the bombing of our center there at Riyadh in 1995. So in 1996, why, of course, the Sudanese are ready to turn Osama bin Laden over to us in return for recognition. Will you tell that story?
Sure. I mean, first of all, they had a selfish reason for wanting to get him out of the country. He had, bin Laden had sided with a faction against the president of Sudan. He was arming and funding that faction against the government. So they were perfectly happy to get rid of him. They also wanted better relations with the United States. So on March 3rd, 1996, they sent a Sudanese general named Fatih Irwa to Washington for a secret meeting with the CIA and the State Department. And I've interviewed everyone, including the Sudanese general, who was in the room that day. And that was followed up with a second meeting in which Sudan made the shocking offer that they would arrest bin Laden and turn him over to us. They never got a clear yes or a clear no. Instead, the Clinton administration dithered for months and then finally said, well, we don't want him, but kick him out of your country. Now, one of the excuses the Clinton people say now, after September 11th, is they never considered the Sudanese offer to be serious. It was incredible, they said. Well, first of all, the Sudanese had, as I just explained, their own selfish reasons for wanting him out of the country. Second of all, they had arrested the infamous international terrorist Carlos the Jackal and turned him over to the French just before, offering to do the same for bin Laden. So they have credibility on this as well. The real reason the Clinton administration didn't take the deal, other than an ideological animus towards Sudan, of course, is that the offer was made in March 1996. Presidential election year, and they did not want to be accused of doing a deal with a terrorist state. Sudan was certainly listed as a state sponsor of terrorism, and they didn't want to be accused on the campaign trail or by the media of doing deals with terrorists. So in the name of protecting themselves politically, they ensured that the arch-terrorist, probably the most dangerous man in the world at the time, was able to go free.
Well, now, didn't the Sudanese even offer to give it all the records that they had of the whole Al-Qaeda network all throughout the world?
That's right. Later in 1996 and again in 1997, they, through various intermediaries, offered to turn over their extensive files on bin Laden. I went to Khartoum, Sudan, and I saw some of those intelligence files. Some of those intelligence files, even reprinted, a few of them anyway, at the back of the book, at the back of Losing Bin Laden. Just look at Appendix B, and you will see intelligence files and exclusive photographs of bin Laden's house, factory, and plane, and so on. So I got a pretty good sense in Khartoum of what they had to offer us. And it was just amazing. The Clinton administration had absolutely no interest in it.
Well, of course, you know, if they were interested in protecting the American people, that's the primary thrust of what you're supposed to do when you're the President of the United States. And, of course, you know, if you could convince the American people what you did was right, that's what a leader does. He doesn't simply look at the polls and say, gee, I better not do anything.
That's right. But there were so many other opportunities after Sudan. A lot of people have heard about Sudan. But, for example, when the Northern Alliance, which you remember those were the folks fighting the Taliban and fighting bin Laden in Afghanistan, in 1999, they sent a man to Washington asking for U.S. help. They thought if they had some money, they could roll back the Taliban without any U.S. forces being involved. And they thought they'd warm up the conversation by saying, by the way, we tried to kill bin Laden three times. I have exclusive details of those three assassination attempts in my book, Losing Bin Laden. And the reaction of the Clinton people was very telling. What the Clinton people did was scold them. How dare you do this? Don't you know that assassination is a violation of U.S. law? Don't you know this is contrary to the rules of war? This just says something really intriguing about the Clinton mindset, that they would want Afghan rebels who were trying to kill bin Laden to stop in the name of...
Well, you even pointed out that we had a Predator plane that was spying on bin Laden and knew exactly where he was and could have taken him out, and instead of that, they grounded it.
That's right. That's right. And that Predator plane and senior CIA officials and President Clinton's own counterterrorism czar, Richard Clark, said to me that they spotted bin Laden on the ground in Afghanistan 3 times.
And of course, he was pretty easy to pick out because he's a Marfan's. He's well over 6 foot, what, 6'5", something like that.
That's right.
He towers over all the rest of the Arabs. And of course,
and also the images were crystal clear, and they watched him in real time. They have a room, a secure facility in Langley, Virginia, in the CIA headquarters, with crystal clear images, big screens, and they're able to watch it, rewind it frame by frame to make absolutely certain that somebody is who they think they are. And 3 times they were dead certain that it was bin Laden. 3 times.
Well, of course, we actually took out one of the Islamic terrorists in Yemen here, three or four months ago with a Predator plane. You know, all but done by remote control.
Yeah, what's fascinating about that, though, is that attack a few months ago with the Predator, is it shows the big difference between the Bush administration and the Clinton administration. In the Clinton administration, the decision to take out bin Laden or Al-Qaeda terrorist had to go all the way to the President of the United States, and he debated it and worried about it and fretted about it, where Bush said, I don't want to know. He left that decision up to the CIA officer on the ground. So the unknown station chief in Yemen made the decision to kill these guys. Bush has pushed the decision-making so far down, so close to the front, that these decisions can be made very quickly, and much fewer of these terrorists can escape us as a result.
Well, now, my understanding is that Dana Rohrabacher, I heard him talk one time about, you know, he found out exactly where bin Laden was. He went to the Clinton administration and said, I know where this arch terrorist is, and they said, well, we're really not interested in it.
That's right. He went to Congressman Porter Goss, who was then chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, and even the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee could not get the CIA interested. It was just incredible.
I heard another time that that there was a plan to actually take out bin Laden, and of course the CIA canceled it. Is there any truth to that?
There is, yeah. That's right. That was a what they're really referring to is what I mentioned earlier, the Northern Alliance plan, where the CIA constantly got involved and tried to stop them from assassinating bin Laden. There was also, and I detail another chapter on this in my book, Losing Bin Laden, about a covert operations plan to send in a team of special forces to take out bin Laden. And, you know, that was just died by 1,000 bureaucratic cuts, even though Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar, really tried to get them to jump through every bureaucratic hoop so they could get this team on the ground and get rid of bin Laden. Clinton never overruled these stupid objections that were raised, such as the army only wanted to do it if they could involve thousands of troops and have a search and rescue plane flying overhead, and the CIA only wanted to do it if they could be guaranteed that none of their men would be shot at, and so on and so on.
Well, of course, you know, what really bothers me, Richard, is that even under the Bush administration, when we went into Afghanistan, there was one thing we should have done, and that was get bin Laden. Instead of that, we dilly-dallied, and we tried to take over the whole country, and we were much more interested in taking over the country than we were in getting bin Laden.
Well, you had to disrupt the Taliban's command and control apparatus. You had to break their hold on territory. Otherwise, Al-Qaeda would just rejuvenate.
Yeah, but I know...
And we also didn't have any exact intelligence as to where bin Laden was at this time.
Well, we had no idea where he was at that time, when we went into Afghanistan?
No, he went into hiding very quickly. In fact, he vanished from our sight shortly after 9/11.
All right, fine. Well, of course, as you followed this whole thing through, why was the Clinton administration refusing to do what it should have done to protect the American people?
Well, because they saw everything through the lens of politics, and they didn't want to take any political risks necessary to protect the country. And another thing, and that is that, and this is something that critics sometimes get to, but they approach it the wrong way. People talk about the scandals distracting Clinton, and really, what the scandals did was force Clinton into the arms of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. He knew he needed them for his political survival. And to do that meant that he had to deliver a very liberal foreign policy. And one thing the McGovernite wing of the Democratic Party does not like is an aggressive foreign policy involving cruise missile strikes, covert operations. So he had to rule all that out in order to keep his hold on the presidency.
But, of course, he did use the cruise missile strikes there when just about the time that Monica was going to be testifying. Of course, you say in your book, though, that he did that. There was real reason for it. I think that was the bombing of the embassies in Africa?
That's right. He had it. Bin Laden certainly had it coming. But, I mean, there should have been cruise missile strikes after the attack on the USS Cole, which killed 17 of our sailors. Instead, Clinton just ignored it. He shrugged his shoulders. There was no retaliation for the attack on the USS Cole.
Well, we're going to have to go to a break now. Do you have to break off, or can you wait around afterwards?
I can wait around a little bit.
All right.
The Anglo-American establishment gives you the documentation for Professor Quigley's allegation that there was a secret society created in England that ultimately came to dominate England and ultimately came to dominate the United States of America. The Anglo-American establishment will give you the books that you can read, written by men who are actually involved in the original secret society. Professor Quigley opens his book saying that most people have heard of the Rhodes Scholarships, and most people, a few people, have actually heard that Cecil Rhodes wrote a confession of faith, which was attached to his first five wills, talking about the formation of a secret society. But what almost no one in America realizes today is that that secret society was actually formed and still exists to this very day. The Anglo-American Establishment by Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, is one of the most important books you'll ever read, and available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Hello, garlic lovers. This is Radio Health journalist Bill Sardi to talk to you about a breakthrough in garlic technology. It's called Alamex. You know all the healthy reasons to take garlic, but isn't it time you got your money's worth? A recent study found the 24 leading brands of garlic pills provided little, if any, allicin, garlic's primary active ingredient. Try Alamex, which is the only odorless garlic supplement to provide pure allicin, a full 180 milligrams. That's the power of 15 fresh cloves of garlic. Alamex isn't available in stores, so call 866-405-4000. That's Alamex at 866-405-4000.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I just want to tell you a little bit about the Big Berkey water filters that we carry here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, we have the Big Berkey, which is a stainless steel water filter. It filters about 2.5 gallons of water at a time. It goes in the top. You pour it in the top. It goes down to the ceramic filters. And, of course, they're coated with silver, so they're self-sterilizing. You don't get any of the silver, though, but it's put there for antiseptic purposes. And then, of course, inside is an activated carbon. And, of course, the water comes out sweet and great tasting, takes out a lot of the chlorine, a lot of the minerals, a lot of the heavy metals, takes out the bacteria. If you want to get much nicer tasting water, or you want to have to filter water from ponds or rivers, or there was any sort of an emergency, here's a way to get good potable water without having to boil it or having to distill it. The Big Berkey ordinarily sells for $239, plus $10 shipping, but it's not available in California or Iowa. However, in California, if you live here and you want to get one, we carry something called the Berkey Light. It's made out of Lexan, which is what they make bulletproof glass out of. The filters are different. They're really much more efficient. They're called black Berkey filters. However, the black Berkey filters have to be replaced every 2 to 4 years. And they're a little bit slower as far as the filter. We have one of these ourselves, but they work, and they work very efficiently on all the water that our family needs. So if you'd like, to see these, you can go to our website, get the pictures, and get more detailed information, radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And, of course, the Berkey Light is $199 plus $10 shipping. If you buy them through us, you get a four-tape set or a video we produce. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like more information, if you would like, of course, to actually order one, why we have them available. And if you want to take out the fluoride, you have to get the PF4 reduction filters. But give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR now. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this afternoon is Richard Miniter. We're talking about his book, Losing Bin Laden, How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleashed the Global Terrorism. And you commented, of course, that when Bill Clinton launched the missiles there, the cruise missiles on Afghanistan and on the aspirin factory the sedan, everybody thought he was doing it that as a wag the dog, a diversion from Monica Lewinsky's testimony. But what was the real truth of that?
Well, I think Bin Laden had it coming. I mean, after you blow up two U.S. embassies, you kill hundreds of people, including more than a dozen Americans, the president had a duty to respond. He had a duty to send missiles or to fight back in some way, to take the fight to Bin Laden. You're just making an open season on Americans around the world. So it was the right decision. It was made in a bad time. Of course, he did get some from it. He got to distract the nation from scandal. But that doesn't mean the situation, the national security case for that decision, was entirely sound. My problem with Clinton is that after that, and after the political criticism of that missile strike, he did not keep up the fight. He did not try to smash al-Qaeda, which was a continuing threat. He just gave up.
Well, of course, I mean, what he should have done is send in a special forces team, identify where he was, put a price on his head, send a special forces team, and eliminate this man. He's already killed enough Americans. You could not leave him there. And of course, Clinton refused to do that.
That's right. That's right.
So, of course,
a park ranger knows that when you have a bear that gets a taste for humans, just keep hunting humans and keep trying to kill them, you have to send someone into the forest and take out the bear. And that's standard practice for any park ranger. States were being hunted by Arab terrorists, and the president kind of shrugs his shoulders and tries to move on.
Well, I remember in 1995 why they allowed al-Zawahiri, who was this, he's now the number two man in al-Qaeda, that we allowed him to come here, tour America, raise funds for the Islamic terrorists. We seem to be giving the Islamic terrorists almost a free ride all through the Clinton administration.
Oh, in the Clinton years, they held open meetings, massive conventions with 300 to 400 people in cities like Oklahoma City. And Zawahiri, number two man in al-Qaeda, who was also one of the founders of Egyptian Islamic Jihad, he was imprisoned in Egypt for the assassination of Anwar Sadat, and then later escaped from prison. He came to visit America openly, under his own name, twice. But here's the most shocking part. His guide, his host on both those trips, was a guy named Ali Mohammed, who was a key terrorist informant for the FBI. But he was also working as a double agent for Bin Laden at the time.
And, of course, we thought this man was working for us, and he was really working for Bin Laden.
That's right. He was taking secret army warfare manuals, translating them into Arabic, and passing them to Bin Laden. He trained Bin Laden's bodyguards. He helped surveil U.S. embassies, target them for bombing. It was just incredible. And yes, this is the FBI. This is the guy the FBI was working with. But if Clinton had allowed the CIA and the FBI to talk to each other, because the CIA knew that Ali Mohammed was a dangerous member of al-Qaeda, but what they didn't know is that he was an FBI informant. The FBI saw him as an informant, but they didn't know about his background. If these agencies could have talked, they could have put the pieces together, and a dangerous double agent which had burrowed into FBI would have been caught far sooner than he was.
Well, of course, on page 8 of your book, you talk about a fellow named Azam. And, of course, Azam is over here going around the United States talking about jihad here in America, how it's the obligation of every Muslim in America to be involved in jihad. And he's talking about fighting and fighting with a sword. In other words, killing people.
That's right. And he was quite open about his desire for holy war. And he was the man who radicalized Bin Laden and turned him against us. I've got a mini biography of Bin Laden and in Chapter 1 of Losing Bin Laden, where I explain why he hates us and who taught him to hate us.
And, of course, there's a lot of thought of this was the teachings of Azam, wasn't it?
Most of it was, yeah. I would say Azam was one of the most dangerous people in the world at the time.
And, of course, this Islamic movement really was not a major force prior to about 1980 when, of course, the Ayatollah Khomeini comes to power, and then, of course, we have the Afghan War. One of the interesting things you point out is that you don't believe that the CIA had anything to do with Bin Laden or funded him at all?
Well, it's not what I believe. It's what I've been told by two CIA station chiefs. There's also, of course, on the record, Bin Laden denies receiving any U.S. funds. There's absolutely no reason why the CIA would have funded him anyway. Bin Laden was known at the time to be violently anti-American. The evidence is all there. I presented in Chapter 1. I think any reader can read it and make up their own mind.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to have to take another break now. And can you stay after you have to take off?
Unfortunately, I think I have to take off.
All right, that's fine. Well, I appreciate you staying.
But I'd be happy to come back anytime.
Well, we will certainly have you scheduled for one of our morning programs, and then we're going to get you for, I think, your tomorrow morning, and then we'll have you for a full hour one of these days. Anyway, God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us, Richard.
Yeah, and I hope your readers go to Amazon.com and check out Losing Weight.
We'll tell them all about the book. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Have you ever wondered about the boys we left behind in Vietnam, in Korea? Did you ever know that we left 25,000 American boys behind in Russia, in Siberia, at the end of the Second World War? Have you ever wondered what really happened in Oklahoma City, what really happened with TWA 800 on the way down off the eastern coast about a year ago? Well, ladies and gentlemen, all of the subjects are well covered in a fascinating book by Craig Roberts entitled The Medusa File. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, order The Medusa File. Actually, Craig Roberts was a police officer working on the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, this book has been suppressed very effectively across America, and it's self-published, but I promise you that there's no other book I know that will give you more contemporary history, frightening history that every American needs to know. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR now.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time I need to tell you about a couple of the things that we carry, and one of them, of course, is Miracle 2 soap products, and we really think that this is really very beneficial. We can't make any medical claims, but I will tell you, I get some of the most amazing stories from the people who use these, and people will tell me their rashes have disappeared, and this or that or the other thing is really dramatically improved, and this is why we carry them. I never thought I'd be selling soap after being an orthopedic surgeon for so many years, but we think it's a great product. We hope that you would like to try them. There is a soap, a moisturizing soap, a neutralizer, which of course the manufacturer suggests you take a little of every day, and some people like to use it for heartburn, other people like to use it for bowel regularity, and all we can do is suggest you try it and see if it'll help you. There's a gel and a lotion. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WARM, and of course the product is Miracle 2 Soap Products. And then of course we carry A Phenopoly set is a program designed to teach you or your children or your grandchildren how to read and spell and pronounce words phonetically. And of course, it's 5 board games, 2 bonus games. It teaches you the basic sounds of the English language, the basic rules of the English language, and teaches you how to read and spell and pronounce properly. So most of these programs, $300, $400, $500. This one's $139.95. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and of course ask about Phenopoly. And of course, when you do that, perhaps you'd like also to ask about the Miracle 2 soap products. Both of them are available here at Radio Liberty. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we had to let Richard Minister go, but right now we've got Fred on the line. Hi, Fred, do you have a question or comment?
Yes, I have a comment. I was reading an article in the 15th paper of this month in our town paper here, and there was an article by a man named David Caruso, Associated Press out of Philadelphia. I'd just like to read the first sentence out of this. It said, in the 2 years since law enforcement agencies gained fresh powers to help track down and punish terrorists, police and prosecutors has increasingly turned the force of the new laws not on Al-Qaeda cells, but on people charged with common crimes.
Well, Fred, would you, Fred?
Then it goes on to a very long story about different...
All right, Fred, would you mind cutting that out and sending that to me?
Yes, I will.
Well, it's Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063.
Okay.
That's Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. And that is, of course, what's wrong with this law. I have nothing against going after the terrorists, but once you give them the power, it will be misused because power corrupts Absolutely everyone.
That's Post Office Box 13?
Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. And this is going on all over the country, and including the federal government is using these laws not on terrorism at all. They are using it, of course, to, in fact, as John Ashcroft said, I'll go after somebody even if they spit on the sidewalk if I want to get them. And that's the whole idea. We're going to get them. Now, the terrorists, yes, certainly we have to stop the terrorists. And, of course, there were certain provisions in the law that allowed them to arrest people and hold them indefinitely. But these people that they arrested immediately after the 9/11 attack, they were, of course, the terrorists that we knew were here all the time. And, of course, what they're not letting the American people know is we had infiltrated the terrorist movement, we knew who the terrorists were, and we arrested them, and that's why we haven't had any more attacks. But we can't tell the American people that, because if we knew who all the terrorists were here in the United States, why didn't we know who the 19 terrorists were that were going to be attacking our facilities? And, of course, those of you who have heard me speak before about Kristen Breitweiser and her statement that testifying before the Joint Select Committee, and she simply quoted the New York Times that within 2 hours of the attack, the FBI, that had no idea there was going to be an attack, had no idea who the terrorists were. They were still at the restaurants where the terrorists ate, at the neighborhoods where they lived, and, of course, at the training schools.
Rounding them up.
Within 2 hours of the attack. Now, come on now. Do you honestly believe they had no idea? Ladies and gentlemen, they're lying to us. And, of course, people who are here illegally do not have any constitutional rights. And, of course, what they want to do is say, well, we have to be able to hold these people. Fine, you hold those people. They're terrorists. And they do not have constitutional rights. But for American citizens, you should not have the ability to take away their freedom, because the Patriot Act was not aimed at Islamic terrorism. It was aimed at law-abiding citizens. And this whole terrorist scam is being used, of course, to justify establishing a fascist society. Not that the terrorists aren't out there. But if you just were listening to this program with Richard Miniter, he pointed out we had 12 opportunities, at least, to take out Osama bin Laden. And I don't believe Bill Clinton was stupid. I think he was a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant man. But you have to understand that Bill Clinton is simply the front man for the establishment that runs America. Bill Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Not a dummy.
And, of course, who are they running now for the Democratic nomination? His name is General Wesley Clark. Who is behind him? Why, the same people who were on Bill Clinton's staff. Lindsey Williams and a couple of the other people, who are associated with Bill Clinton. And, of course, Wesley Clark just happens to be a Rhodes Scholar and from the Council on Foreign Relations.
Same people.
Right. And, of course, these people give incest a bad name. They, of course, want to make us think there's a tremendous groundswell of support for General Wesley Clark. No, they're creating it. He's a very attractive, very intelligent, very articulate member of the elite who ruined America, and they're going to give us a choice of two candidates. We will vote for the candidates of their choice, and we can pick either one, and it won't matter at all. We can throw the scoundrels out, and the same policy will continue.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks so much for calling, Fred. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. Pardon me. If you want to order any of our products, but if you'd like to give us a call right now, it's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we'd love to have you call because, of course, we don't have anything prepared. But, of course, if you go into the background of Osama bin Laden, and the reason I asked Richard Miniter about the CIA funding him, he said, well, he talked to two people from the CIA who said, we did not fund Osama bin Laden. Well, there is no question that the CIA funded the Mujahideen, who were the holy warriors, the holy Islamic warriors. And, of course, they were working with Osama bin Laden in the war. And, of course, whether we gave Osama bin Laden any money, I don't think we did. He didn't need our money. But we were funding the warriors that he was manipulating in this battle. we recruited the Mujahideen, and that is the word holy warriors. It means fighting for the religion. And they were brought in from Malaysia. They were brought in from Indonesia. They were brought in from all over the Arab world, all over the Muslim world. And, of course, here they were to be indoctrinated in this radical Islamic faith, and they were to fight the infidels, who were, of course, the Soviets. And, of course, the CIA funded that war, and Osama bin Laden was directing much of this. Now, he wasn't actually in the front lines, certainly fighting, but he was the spiritual head of this whole Islamic movement during that time. You have to remember that the number one man was Azam, and we were talking about Azam. We allowed him to come to America and preach killing Americans right here in this country. If you have not yet seen the video Islamic Jihad by Stephen Emerson, you need to, because you'll actually see pictures of Azam there talking about how we're going to have to kill Americans, and it's your duty if you're a Muslim living in America to fast and, of course, to fight jihad, to fight with the sword. And he's talking about killing people. Now, I believe that those are probably FBI pictures that that Stephen Emerson had. I don't know that for a fact. But I do know that when Stephen Emerson put this powerful, powerful video together, pointing out there was 80 Islamic terrorist centers in the United States. There were 3 Islamic training camps where they were training them in the use of explosives and the use of weapons, and this was all known by the FBI. Now, what happened to those people? Why aren't they, of course, out there committing terrorist acts? Because we've got them all arrested. Our intelligence agencies are incredibly efficient. In fact, we have not only arrested all of them here in the United States, we've either arrested or killed 2/3 of the leaderships of Al-Qaeda throughout the world today. The only ones we can't seem to find are Bin Laden and al-Zawahiri. And I, for one reason or another, we either don't want to find them or they're on our payroll. I do not know why we can't find them. Maybe we need them there because we have to have somebody as a rallying cry, of course, to mobilize the people behind. We do have an article that was put out in the Washington Times, and it was, of course, during the early part of the Afghan war, where a highly placed official told the Washington Times reporter, our Bin Laden policy is not Osama bin Laden first, it's Osama bin Laden last, because if we took out Osama bin Laden early during the Afghan war, how would we justify the rest of the war? And of course, if you were going to go to war, the one thing you should have done was get bin Laden and forget about the Taliban. I mean, you know, we'd backed them in the past. Many of these people had been educated in schools that we financed with our textbooks into this crazy radical Islamic faith. And, of course, all we've done, of course, is kill a lot of people. And now, of course, the Taliban are regrouping in Afghanistan. And they're going to keep fighting until, of course, they take the country back again. Are we going to stay there 50 years? We're going to have to if we're ever going to have any hope of winning, because these people are not going to give up. Let's go to Mike in Arizona. But the big problem is we never should have helped to finance this whole radical Islamic movement and worked with the Saudi Arabians, who were financing it, and the Pakistani intelligence, which was financing it and providing textbooks to school people in the radical Islamic belief. And if you doubt that we did that, we'll be glad to send you a copy of the article out of the Washington Times. We'll be glad to verify anything we're saying. And we have other books that go into the background of how the CIA was, of course, working with Al-Qaeda. The American government was financing the Taliban in 1994 because we wanted to bring stability to Afghanistan so we could run a pipeline across there. And the trouble was, when the Taliban came to power, they wouldn't let us put in the pipeline. Well, that, of course, was where, of course, they made their most serious mistake. Because, of course, when the United States tells you that this is what you're to do and you don't do it, why, of course, the next thing you know, you're at war. Let's go to Mike in Arizona. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Stan. I'm afraid all I can do is agree with you for the most part. Your last guess was a little bit misinformed. We know that the CIA section chief over in Dubai met with bin Laden when he was in the American hospital over there for about 10 days.
Now, how do we know that?
July. This was reported in
The India Times, and of course...
I think it was India Times.
Right, in fact, we did a wonderful interview last night with Paul Sperry. I think it's going to be a tape of the month, and we even covered that. He's the Washington correspondent for the Washington, for WorldNet Daily, and he acknowledged that. Anybody who wants to get the documentation on what Mike just said, go to Infowars.com, look at prior knowledge. You'll see the reference to the articles out of the India Times and out of the Southeast Asia Times talking about Osama bin Laden meeting with the CIA station chief in Dubai. Why would he be doing that if he's our enemy? Or
the whole thrust of our intelligence effort seems to be stirring up a hornet's nest in the Middle East, encouraging hatred against the West by, of course, arming the Israelis with every weapon known to man and leaving them virtually disarmed. But also, even more subtly, you know, the CNN, a friend of mine, was in the Middle East when his daughter was back here in the States, and he was able to compare the same story on CNN over in, he was actually in Egypt at the time, versus how the story ran in the U.S. In Egypt, they showed a picture of the Israelis blowing up an ambulance that was going to try to help some injured Palestinians who'd been shot or blown up. And the Israelis claimed that the ambulance was driving too fast, so they had to fire a rocket at it and blow it up. And I think they killed a couple of UN workers in the process.
But Mike, you have to understand.
My point is that, but at the same time, in the UN or in the U.S., that story wasn't even shown. So they obviously want to stir up hatred against Israel and against America. But we don't even see that here in the States. We get a very different, you know, version of the news.
Oh, you're absolutely right. In fact, we have these wonderful video clips that are shown on the Islamic television in a video called The New Barbarians, where they're training, you know, 6- and 8-year-old kids to hate America and to die as bombers. But you have to, if you look at what's happening between Israel and the Palestinians, understand we're financing both sides. We've kept the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, intact. It was about to be eliminated back in the 80s. Reagan, of course, evacuated to Tunisia, rearmed it, refinanced it, and then sent it back over into Palestine, of course, the Palestinian area, so that we would have this conflict. And this, we're financing Arafat, we're financing the Israelis. What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, but when are we going to have some accountability from our intelligence agencies? This constant claim of national security and we can't disclose anything that we do. Everything's classified. I didn't care much for Pat Moynihan's politics, but I did like his approach to intelligence, and he wanted a far more transparent intelligence organization. And
well, I'll tell you
what. We need to know what these people are doing.
When we get an honest man in the White House, and that's what we're working on, I'll tell you more about that in a couple of weeks. Okay.
All right, take care, Stan.
God bless. And let's go to Jim and Salinas. Hi, Jim.
Yes, Dr. Stan. By the way, I am happy to say that Brotherhood of Darkness is sold at Monterey Bible Bookstore here.
Well, thank you so very much. I hope did you encourage them to put it in there?
Well, I complimented them on having it. I purchased it there.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so much, and I'm just so glad that they have it.
Yeah, I wanted to revisit yesterday's program topic because I found a couple of the assertions rather disturbing.
Now, okay, what was disturbing to you?
Well, the notion, for example, that the logotype on the New King James Bible had anything at all to do with 666.
Have you looked at it?
Yes, I certainly have. I have one of those in my possessions. It is 3 interlocking arcs. There's no loop creating a 6 anywhere to be found on it.
I would just suggest that people look at it, and if you are looking for the 6s, you can see it. Hey, we're just about out of time. Anything else you want to say?
Well, you know, it seems to me that a lot of these things may be expropriated by Luciferians and other evil people, but that doesn't necessarily make the symbols themselves Luciferian or evil.
Well, I think what you have to understand, Jim, is they always have a dual meaning. They have one meaning to the dark side, and of course we look at them, they hide them in plain sight if we don't even see them.
Well, yeah, I think sometimes I see them, but I think they've got two meanings, and I prefer to go with the positive rather than the negative.
Of course, of course you do, and that's the most normal thing in the world. But the trouble is, do not shortchange the people on the other side. They are wickedly and diabolically intelligent. Hey, thanks so much. We got to take one more call. Let's go to George in Toronto. Hi, George. How are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Monteith. Quickly, could you just, and I'll listen off the air, could you please make some further comments about Arnold Schwarzenegger in the state of California, please?
Okay, fine. Well, of course, Arnold ties into the Bohemian Grove. I'd suggest you go to, Alex Jones' website. He's got a section on him. Arnold has been over at the Rothschild Castle with, of course, Buffett. Arnold Schwarzenegger is, of course, being run by the establishment as the spoiler to make sure we don't have an opportunity to get a man who loves America, who, of course, is a good conservative and a God-fearing man, into the position of governor of the state of California. That's the reason Schwarzenegger is running. And, of course, that's the reason he's getting a pretty good play from the media. Of course, he has George Shultz behind him. George Shultz is one of the kingmakers, one of the elite. Of course, he was in the Reagan Secretary of State, associated with, of course, Gorbachev, State of the World Forum, on the board of directors, or the originally there. And, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger will not have my vote. And I think the American people have to understand that they will do anything to keep a good man who will represent the American people for becoming governor of the state of California. And so if the election goes ahead, I hope you will do everything you can to encourage people to vote for a principled man in the election, and you'll have to decide who that is. But we're out of time. We'll be back here in just a moment.
Our 4-tape set on the JFK assassination includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination, a 2-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of the American president, and then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out, and if you listen to this 4-tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination tape.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I just want to mention, of course, a couple of things. One of them is, of course, I'm going to be speaking at the meeting. It's going to be the Southwest Radio Church. It's going to be up at in Pleasanton, where 580 and 680 cross. It's at 9 o'clock this coming Saturday at the Hilton Hotel. If any of you are interested in going up there, why, I'll be giving my talk on Iraq, the Untold Story. But they're going to be a fascinating group of speakers there. And if you're interested, that'll be this Saturday. I will be speaking in Pleasanton at the Southwest Radio Church conference there. And if you need any more information, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you call the Southwest Radio Church before Saturday and make a reservation, why, you won't cost anything to get in. Otherwise, it'll cost you $10. And I don't get anything for people coming, but if you're interested, it should be an interesting program. And then, of course, we want to, of course, mention that we hope that many of you out there will be interested in going to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. where, of course, you can listen to our radio programs 5 hours a day on the Internet. You can pull down our newsletters, and we certainly give you our permission to copy those newsletters because, of course, we want you to get them in other people's hands. We want people to read about what's going on, to understand the true nature of the evil that we face today. Because really what this is a spiritual battle being played out on a political, ideological battlefield, and we always try to make excuses for what's going on. I mean, why the Supreme Court is anti-God. the Red Eye God, because, of course, they were demonic people who were put on there. They were people who were appointed to the Supreme Court to take God out of our schools and out of our public institutions and prayer. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to finance what we do 5 hours every day as we reach out across America, indeed across the world, on the Internet and shortwave and on satellite and on radio stations and buying radio time. And so we're up to about, of course, almost 50 nine different outlets every week. A lot of them are just half an hour, but at least they're hearing the truth that they've never heard before. So we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. A suggested gift of $20 a month or more, you'll get our four best tapes of the month, you'll get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, you'll be helping us as we try to educate the people about this spiritual battle in which we're engaged. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, of course, we'd be glad to get that for you. Send you one if you just give us a call at that number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Of course, we want to mention that, of course, we carry the Phenopoly sets. If you would be interested in getting a Phenopoly set to teach your children and your grandchildren yourself how to read or spell or pronounce words phonetically, why, of course, they're $139.95 in contrast to the $300, $400, $500, $600 for most of these programs that will teach you how to read phonetically. So give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask about Phenopoly. And then, of course, we also want to mention that if you go to our website at radioliberty.com, you can see the various products that we offer, and there's a section there on the Phenopoly and on some of the soap products we carry. And then, of course, on the big Berkey water filters and the Berkey light water filters, you can actually see them there. And if you decide you want to get one and you buy it through Radio Liberty, you'll get a four-tape set or a video that we produced. And remember our website, it's radioliberty.com. Now, one of the things that you can do to help America is to set up an Institute of the Constitution in your community, your church, and, of course, you can do that by calling 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068. And, of course, request a packet for the Institute of the Constitution. It's 12-week programs. You can put it on a weekend with 2 days, but either that or 12 successive programs, and you can teach people about the miracle of America, why America was different than any other nation, why we were once the city on the hill, why we're the envy of the whole world. And if you'd like to know about America's Constitution and help us to rekindle that flickering flame of freedom that's about to be extinguished, you're going to have to do it. I can only do so much. You can set up an Institute of the Constitution. It's a turnkey operation. All you have to do, of course, is certainly go ahead and call 410-760-9068. And then, of course, we want you to tell others about our radio programs. We want, of course, to tell others about the website, radioliberty.com, and encourage people to go to radioliberty.com and to listen to our programs and to get the information that they will need to be effective in this battle. And, of course, we did a wonderful program last night with Paul Sperry on, of course, the oil situation in the Middle East. It'll be a tape of the month, but you can pull that down off of our archive programs, the interview we did last night. We recommend it to you. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival. We ask you to pray for our